All right, thanks. So, hi everyone. Good morning. Thanks for showing up on time. I brought this helmet just in case I anger anyone here. I have a little bit of protection. So, if you're going to hit me, please hit me on top of the head. Anyhow, I don't think anything I say will be too controversial, but just in case, I'm protected. But I'm going to keep it here, so. All right, here we go.
Paul Edison wears a mask.
I know. I know. Well, the stuff he's saying makes people really angry. I'm trying not to make anyone too angry. We'll see. So, it's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank the organizers again for including me in this conference and this program. I'm having a really nice time. And what I'm going to talk to you guys about today are models for the formation of kind of the hot super-Earths or the sub-Neptunes or the mini-Neptunes or the low-mass, low-density planets, those kind of planets. And this is in collaboration with a number of people. In particular, Andre Isidoro is a postdoc who is here, sitting right there. So here we go. We've seen this kind of plot before: planetary size versus orbital distance. And each of these dots corresponds to a Kepler planet or candidate planet. And so this big clump right here jumps right out at you. This is what we're talking about. These are the kind of super-Earths or mini-Neptunes. And for the rest of the talk, I'm going to use those words interchangeably. I'm not going to talk too much about what puffs them up. And so I'll just talk about super-Earths, and that'll mean these guys right here. And for scale, the Earth is out there, just so you know. So hot super-Earths, that's what we're talking about. So what else do we know about them? Well, we know that they're very common. They exist around something like a third to a half of all main sequence stars. And they often come in multiple systems with many planets. And when they do, they tend to be on quite compact orbital configurations with lots of planets squished in a relatively small space, but usually not locked in orbital resonances. So here are some examples that I grabbed from the Kepler catalog. And each of these systems has at least four planets. None of the planets is larger than 1.5 Earth radii. And you can see the x-axis is a little weird. It's in logarithmic scale, on logarithmic scale. The reason for that is there's one of these systems that looks kind of funny that's not supposed to be there. That might look familiar to some of you. I'll show you what that is. This bottom one is the solar system's terrestrial planets with all their semi-major axes chopped in by a factor of 10. So this is not really where the Earth is, of course. But since this is on a log scale, this preserves basically the dynamical spacing of the system. So the distance between any two planets is representative of their period ratio. And so what you can see is the period ratio of Earth and Venus. It's kind of typical of the ones that we see in these kind of systems. There's some that are really, really compact, some a little bit wider, but Earth-Venus separation is kind of typical. So the question I'm going to talk about is, how do systems like this form? So the context, let me give you guys kind of a background slide of the big picture, what we think is going on. So the setting for planet formation is a disk of gas and dust orbiting young star. Now, how do we get to planets? Well, we start off with tiny little dust grains. Those can collide and stick and form things that are a little bit bigger, things we usually call pebbles. These, again, can be concentrated to form larger macroscopic bodies, planetesimals. You know, think like the asteroids in Star Wars, these kind of things. Then these guys collisionally coalesce to form planetary embryos. And the exact sizes of both planetesimals and planetary embryos is not that well constrained. But you can think of planetary embryos as typically being maybe Mars-sized or so. That's why I use Mars there. Now, while there's still gas in this disk, several things can happen that are interesting. Pebbles and planetesimals also, they spiral inward very quickly. As Saurav was telling us about yesterday, these objects are the ones that are most sensitive to aerodynamic drag, and they can spiral inward on a very short timescale. Likewise, planetary embryos undergo gravitational interactions with the disk, and that causes them to migrate. It's called type one migration. This little cartoon here, this little picture here, is a planet embedded in a disk launching density waves. Those density waves push back on the planet's orbit and cause its orbit to usually shrink, but not always. Likewise, while there's still gas in the disk, that's when you can accrete gas onto a planet. and make a rocky thing or an icy thing into a gas-dominated thing. Now, when there's no more gas in the disk, there's kind of a final assembly of giant impacts between any planetary embryos that are left. These impacts can have been occurring while the gas is still there, of course, but their last chance is after the gas goes away, last phase of impacts, and then that's what you see. And we see these super Earths or mini Neptunes. So this is kind of the big picture of what we think is going on to form these planets. Now, we've been thinking about this for a while. The first time I thought about this was actually at a conference in 2007 that was organized by Eric Guidos and Nader Hagigipour, who are both here, actually. And so at that time, in 2008, I put together a list of a whole bunch of different mechanisms that might explain how you get planets that are kind of super Earth-like close into their stars. And you can tell this is dated, because at the time I called them hot Earths, because super Earths hadn't come out yet. Right? That name was still waiting to be come out. Anyhow, what I'd propose is a bunch of different models that could do this, and there were kind of a couple of different observable quantities that could hopefully differentiate between the models. Those were the kind of the orbital architecture of the system and the composition of these planets. And I don't want you to read all these things, but suffice to say that there's hope of telling apart planet formation models from something you can observe. Now, at the moment, the bottom four of those have kind of been ruled out, at least for explaining the majority of systems. And there's two that are still viable, and that's the in-situ formation or orbital migration. And if you're reading all these words that I put there, I should mention that specifically this quantity here, the system architecture of systems that form by type 1 migration, I no longer think requires resonance. And I'll explain that in a little bit. All right, so let's take a step back. Okay, here's a little plot of size versus orbital distance. We'll say the hot super Earths are up here. How could they have gotten there? Well, maybe they just started down here as small bodies and locally grew to become hot super Earths. Maybe the building blocks that grew them drifted in from further out, and you still built the planets locally, but from material that did not start off there. Or maybe you grew the planets further out, or at least their building blocks, and then they migrated inward. Or maybe some combination of all these. It doesn't have to be straight lines. Maybe there's some curves along here. So in the rest of the talk, what I'm going to do is go through three of the models. I'll go through in situ, the drift model, and the migration model, talk about how they work, what's good about the model, what's bad about the model, and how they match up. All right, so let's jump in. In situ accretion. This proposes that planets can form close to their stars from very high mass disks. The disks have to be high mass, so you have enough stuff to build the planets there, of course. So here's a simulation, snapshots in a simulation of in-situ accretion. Here we were trying to reproduce a specific Kepler system, but this process is pretty generic. So what you see are snapshots in time. We started off with about 15 Earth masses of solid bodies, of planetary embryos and planetesimals within about half an AU. That's something like 10 to 20 times more than you would get from a standard minimum mass solar nebula model, for those of you who know what that is. But you can see what happens is there's kind of a wave of growth that sweeps outward, and pretty big things form. So in the bottom panel, the masses are labeled. So we form a 6 Earth mass guy, 2.5, 3, 1.7. We're forming pretty big planets close in where they should be. But for those of you who are looking at the size of these circles, you can see within a few hundred years, these guys are about the same size as, you know, these guys. You're forming things that are about 1 or 2 Earth masses in timescales that are ridiculously short, 100 years, maybe 1,000 years. So it's very, very fast. Okay. So this simulation did not assume any gas. This model, the in-situ accretion model, assumes kind of a gas-free environment. But is that really a good assumption? Well, this plot shows the fraction of stars that have observed disks that are thought to represent the presence of gas as a function of their age. This is kind of a classical plot. And what you can see is very young stars, pretty much all of them have gas disks, and old stars don't. And the time scale for those disks going away is a few million years. Okay, remember we were forming planets that are one or two Earth masses in like 1,000 years. So the punchline is, if hot super Earths form in situ, then the gas should still be there when objects are big. Yeah. There's no way around this. You need a massive disk to form things in situ. If you have a massive disk, they form fast. If they form fast, there's still gas. Right, that's so what should happen? What does it matter that gas is there? What's the effect that that's going to have on these growing planets? Well, the key thing is orbital, it's going to change the orbits of planets. And the most important effect is orbital decay, inward spiraling of objects of different sizes. And so here are different size scales. And now here come a bunch of arrows. So the length of these arrows represents how strong the inward drift is. And so for small guys, things are like pebbles. I mentioned this in passing. Pebbles feel really strong aerodynamic drag. All right, dust is basically coupled to the gas. It doesn't have much differential movement compared to the gas. Once objects get large, they orbit at the Keplerian speed, while the gas is orbiting a little bit slower. And so these objects feel a strong headwind, and that causes them to lose energy. Basically, the drag from that causes them to lose energy and drift inward. Now, as you get larger and larger, you have the same headwind, but the objects are more massive. They have more energy, basically more inertia. It's harder to have them spiral in. Then at larger sizes, there's gravitational interactions with the disk, this so-called type 1 migration, that is a function of the planet mass. And so this kicks in around Mars, Earth mass-ish. And from then on, you can get quite fast inward drift. But in between, there's not that much. All right, so now let's look at some of the known planets. And what I've done here is take each of a bunch of known hot super-Earths and said, to form that super-Earth in situ, I must have formed it in a pretty massive disk. Okay? And I can calculate about what that mass should be locally. Then based on that mass, that disk should be causing some migration. And what would be the time scale of that migration? And this is what you get from that kind of calculation. So here's the type 1 migration time scale for these planets as a function of orbital distance. Remember, assuming they formed in situ from very massive disks. And the punchline here is the numbers are small. They're much smaller than the gas disk lifetime. So since we think these things can form fast, and there's still gas there, it doesn't really make sense to ignore the gas. Now, lots of people are not fans of type 1 migration. I think because the field has actually changed substantially in the last 10 years or so. Lots of details of type 1 migration are in evolution and are now being understood a bit better. So say you just don't like type 1 migration. Here is a different argument. Now, this is the same kind of calculation. Each of these points is for a specific Kepler planet or planet candidate. And don't pay too much attention to the x-axis here. This is the isolation mass. This is the mass scale of the building blocks of these planets. And Hilke is going to talk in much more detail about that next. So don't worry too much about this. What's shown on the y-axis is the time scale for aerodynamic drag. So even though these guys are big, and we usually think of aerodynamic drag being insignificant for large bodies, if your disk is massive enough, it's not insignificant. And so what you can see in this plot is the aerodynamic drag time scale for planets within about 0.1 or 0.2 AU are still much shorter than the gas disk lifetime. So even aerodynamic drag should be causing radial drift in these systems. So, get the dust again. So the punchline is, if hot super-Earths form in situ, then they must interact strongly with the gaseous disk. And then that brings up, because the disk should make them drift or migrate, then they're not really forming in situ in the first place. And this is kind of why I brought the helmet, in case anyone's going to come attack me. Okay, no attackers yet. All right. On to the next model. I'm not going to talk much about this because Saurav gave a really nice talk about this yesterday. But there's another model that proposes that you can drift in the building blocks of hot super-Earths from further out, even though they're mostly assembled close in. So here's a cartoon of that model. In a disk, there's kind of a boundary between these blue and red zones that can be a trap for inward migrating pebbles. And so the idea is the pebbles migrate inward, They get trapped at that location. They form a very dense ring that can collapse into a planet. Then you can kind of keep doing this successively, forming planets that are further and further out. So planets form from the inside out. And it's a cool model. I'm not going to talk more about it, but I think, in my opinion, this is a really cool model. It's really promising, and it makes a lot of sense. It fits in the picture of what we think should be going on. So now I'm going to go on to my own favorite model. And you can tell it's my favorite because there's a bunch of animations. And you don't usually make animations for the other guys. Nothing against the other guys. So this model is the inward migration of large bodies. So the picture you should have in your head is something like this. All right, mass versus orbital distance. Planetary embryos grow out of smaller bodies. And then the big guys that form further out migrate inward. And you get a system of hot superbirds. That's the kind of cartoon picture. Now, why should they be migrating anyway? Oh, you can see one thing to point out is as they were migrating, they were going up. That's presumably from collisions with other bodies during migration. And I'll show you some movies of simulations in a sec. So why should objects be migrating anyway? Well, a planet that's embedded in a gas disk, so here's the planet embedded in a gas disk, creates density perturbations in that disk. So the two most prominent ones are these spiral arms launched at the inner and outer Lindblad resonances. And there's another very important perturbation that you can just kind of barely see in this picture. And that's along the horseshoe region, basically for gas that is on the same orbit as the planet. It's called the co-rotation zone, usually. And so there are different torques that act on the planet's orbit from these different density perturbations. And the net torque from these Lindblad resonances tends to go inward, tends to drive the planets inward to shrink their orbits, make them move closer to their star. Whereas in the regime of kind of super Earth-sized planets, the co-rotation torque from this material out here tends to be positive. It tends to push planets outward. So migration can actually be inward or outward, and I'll show you examples of both in a sec. And the time scale, you know, it depends on what's going on with the mass of the disk, the mass of the planet, and so on. But what we typically think of time scales is, you know, 10 or 100,000 years, something like that. And the time scale scales inversely with the planet mass. So bigger things migrate faster. And this is all taking place in the context of a protoplanetary disk. Now, I don't want you to read any of these words, so I'm quickly going to zoom. I just want to show you that this is happening in a disk, and we're thinking about the whole disk structure. Now, let's zoom into the part that I want to talk about, and that's the inner parts of the disk. So the key thing is the disk does not go all the way to the star. Very early in its history, there are events where the disk might actually touch the surface of the star. But we think at the later stages of formation, after the first few 100,000 years anyway, the disk does not touch the star. Rather, the gas accretes onto the star along magnetic field lines. So if I'm a planet out here and I'm migrating along, what should I do? I should actually go and get stuck at the inner edge of the disk. There's a really strong torque at the inner edge of the disk that compensates the, a positive torque at the inner edge that compensates what's driving me inward. And so it makes sense for planets to get trapped at any strong density gradient like the inner edge of the disk. So if planets are migrating, we think they should actually stop there. They shouldn't just be falling on the star. Now let me show you guys a plot that's quite complicated, so I'll walk you through it slowly. This is a migration map. So what we've done here is take a disk model, calculate its thermal structure, you know, its surface density structure and all that stuff. Then based on that, calculate how planets should migrate of different masses in different positions within the disk. And so what I'm showing you here is the planet mass versus orbital distance. Okay, and the colors correspond to how the planet should migrate. Now the inner edge of the disk is at 0.1 AU. And so this red right here represents kind of the stopping of migration at the inner edge of the disk. All colors that are kind of orange and red are outward migration, and colors that are blue or green are inward migration. So you can see, kind of just follow the arrows, that's where the migration should go. Within this zone here, migration would be out. So the solid lines encompass regions of outward migration. And this is for a specific disk, but we've tried this for a zillion different disk models, and this kind of basic structure shows up almost all the time, where you have a big lobe, some people call it an egg, of outward migration at a few AU. So now what should happen to my planet that's migrating around there now? Well, if it's small, then it should just kind of skirt underneath this zone and migrate into the inner edge of the disk like we saw before. But some other things can happen. What if it gets to this point and it bashes into something else? Then its mass will go up, and then it should migrate outward. And it shouldn't just go out forever. It should get trapped somewhere where all the torques balance out. We often call these kind of zero torque zones or convergence zones, if you ever see that in the literature. So there's kind of two qualitatively different outcomes. As things are migrating inward, either they get piled up in here, or if they grow fast enough, they can turn around and go out here. And so qualitatively, I'm going to link these two outcomes to hot super-Earths or mini-Neptunes, and what we would think of as the cores of giant planets. So any object that manages to get out here does not migrate in quickly. It has a long time to spend out at several AU, where it's much more favorable to accrete gas and presumably become a giant planet. That's the idea. Now let me show you a simulation of this process. So we're seeing mass versus orbital distance. This is the same disk model I just showed you, just kind of zoomed out slightly. The gray zones are zones of outward migration. And what you'll see is we kind of just seeded this disk with a whole bunch of planetary embryos between about 1 and 20 AU. So let's just see what happens. These guys migrate inward, they kind of bash into each other, they reach the inner edge of the disk and they stop. Sometimes they get kicked interior to the inner edge of the disk, sometimes they don't. This guy managed to jump into this egg of outward migration fast enough and became what we would consider a candidate giant planet core. And at the inner edge of the disk, you know, in the inner parts of the disk, we form a system of a bunch of what I would call hot super-Earths. Things are, you know, five-ish Earth masses locked in a chain of orbital resonances that's just camping out there. Now, this doesn't look like what we see. These are all in resonances. And I told you before that I don't think they should stay in resonance. And the reason is this is just while the gas is still around. This is an extreme example to illustrate what's going on. We don't think the gas should stick around for 10 million years anyway. We don't think it should stay that dense for that long at least. So what should really be happening if the gas is evolving? Well, let me show you. Here's a plot of a different simulation that I did, that I just dug up the other day, of orbital distance versus time. Okay, so the gas only lasts for this tiny little blip in here for about 3 million years. So all the action we saw before is done right there. And then the gas goes away. So at this point, in this simulation, there's actually a chain of 9 planets within half an AU in this resonant chain. So you can read off these resonances. The two inner planets are particularly close in the 7-6 resonance. But you see, this doesn't last that long. It goes unstable. The two inner guys go unstable after about 25 million years. The rest of these inner guys explode after about 30 million years. And at the end of this simulation, we ran it to 100 million years. There's a system with only 3 kind of super-Earth-sized planets within about half an AU. It's important to note that this destabilization more often happens kind of at the end of this part, while the gas is actually going away. I chose this example just because it's a little prettier to show. But this destabilization is pretty generic. There's only a handful of systems where they stay in resonant chains for a long time. Right? And that's basically because of the cumulative gravitational effects of all these guys. Okay. So the punchline is, again, even though these things form by migration, and even though they were locked into a chain of resonances, we don't expect that to last forever. Right? We don't require observing a bunch of resonances in this model. Okay. Now, there's another attractive feature of this model that it can explain something about the solar system that we now think is weird, which is why don't we have any super-Earths in our solar system? So we have proposed, this is a paper by Andre sitting right there, that if, as these cores, as these planetary embryos are migrating inward, if the innermost one grows quickly, quickly enough to actually become not only a core of a giant planet, but an actual gas giant planet. If it can do that fast enough, then that can actually act to block the migration of other bodies further out. And so Jupiter, in this context, would be a barrier to the inward migration of Saturn's core and of Uranus and Neptune. And so in that context, the gas giants are really the protectors of the galaxy. Planets like Earth would be invaded by super-Earths that are migrating inward were it not for gas giants. And the nice thing about this model is it makes a clear prediction that we can test. The prediction is that systems with lots of hot super-Earths should be anti-correlated with systems that contain Jupiter-like gas giants. It's not a one-to-one thing, because sometimes the embryos do jump over the orbit of the gas giant, and sometimes maybe it's not the innermost one who becomes the gas giant. But on a statistical level, this is a clear prediction from that model. So this should be testable in the coming years, especially with data sets that combine, you know, hot super-Earths and more distant giants. So just to wrap this up with another little cartoon that I like doing. So here's our picture again. Mass versus distance, we grow these planetary embryos, but now this guy became a Jupiter. And it holds up the inward migration of these other guys. And then some other stuff happens. Oh, geez, that looks so nice. Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that was going to happen. That's a surprise. Okay. I should mention that there are uncertainties in this model, even though I know it didn't look like there were any uncertainties, but there's some. So just to give, I don't want to be too harsh on the other models and too nice to my own. So let me explain what doesn't work, or that we don't know, at least in this model. The initial conditions. How many embryos are migrating? How big are they? Where should they have formed? What are they made of? Lots of details of the type 1 migration, because it depends quite sensitively on what's going on in the disk. What do disks really look like? That's still not that well known. How efficient is actually the capture of a gas envelope during this migration? And what's the importance of turbulence during this migration also? So these are all things that are kind of up in the air that we don't know yet. Now let me talk just for a sec about the predicted compositions of super-Earths based on how they formed. What this plot shows is the water content of objects that we think were the building blocks of planets in the solar system. So we don't have any measurements of exactly what went into forming the Earth. What we do have are the remnants, the leftovers of planet formation in the form of meteorites, in the form of asteroids, and other small bodies. And here's what we think right now in terms of the water content of these bodies as a function of distance. Close in, everything was dry. As you go further out, there's more and more water. Beyond something like, you know, a few AU, there was a significant amount of water. These guys are often invoked as having delivered the water to Earth. So if planets are forming very close in, they should be dry. That's clear. Now the question is, if they migrate, where do they migrate from? Do these embryos form as C-type kind of compositions, like carbonaceous chondrites? Do they form further out where they might have a lot more water? And we don't know. So I think it's reasonable to assume, you know, that there could be a range of compositions of planetary embryos that form and then migrate. I wouldn't expect them to be all dry, but I don't think it's required that they're all solid ice balls either. So I'm sorry, I don't have a firm number on this, but I think there could be a range. Okay, now let me conclude. All right, the first point I wanted to make was that if hot super-Earths form in situ, then they form fast, they get big while the gas is still there, and they should be interacting with the gas disk. And they should be suffering some kind of drift, either due to aerodynamic drag or type 1 migration. And in that case, then we have to rethink what in situ actually means. The pebble drift model, I didn't say much about it because Sarov covered it yesterday. I think it's very promising. It makes a lot of sense. It needs some further study to kind of firm it up. And the migration model, I think the one attractive feature of the model that I presented, the one with all the movies, in case you don't remember, that model, what's attractive about it is it tries to explain a lot of things at once. It's got testable predictions, or, you know, maybe it's wrong and we'll prove that by testing these correlations. And the nice thing is that you can try to explain the origin of hot supers and the cores of giant planets in the same framework. And I just want to finish by saying that, in my mind, the pebble drift model and the migration model are kind of two pieces of the same big idea. Both of these processes should be happening. And I don't think it's clear right now which one is responsible for forming the hot super-Earths, but I think it makes sense that both are occurring within the general context of planet formation. So I don't see really a conflict between these guys. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay, he'll have many questions.
Done. I'm getting ready. Let's go.
That was a really nice talk, firstly. For those models where you showed, you know, multiple planets in a long chain of resonance, and then later they went unstable, and only a few survived, what sort of eccentricities do you expect for the survivors?
I just looked at yesterday. What was the answer? I think it was a few percent. I think it was like 5%-ish. I can look that up for you easily. I don't have the number on the top of my head. But it wasn't above 0.1, 0.15.
So these lobes of moving out, can you give us a sense why they are there and how do they depend on the profile of the
coast? Which part are you talking about exactly?
These lobes of moving out.
Oh, these the eggs of outward migration.
The two of them.
So I showed this one because it's the one that my student calculated. I should have put a slide of what I think are the best ones out there right now. They're being done by Bertrand Beach, who actually calculates a self-consistent 3D model. And this kind of general qualitative shape is basically very common. He, you know, turns all his knobs and he almost always gets a structure like this. That said, the details change. For example, this little blob can either be there or not. It turns out that in the simulations, it never ends up doing much. So it doesn't matter too much. What matters is this guy out here. And the structure of this guy in Baird's models, which I think are a bit better, they don't have this little blip going upward. That depends on exactly how you're calculating the co-rotation torque in that part of the disk, which can be a little tricky. That the most interesting thing that I've seen recently is there's some new, I can't say the most exciting thing I've seen in general recently, but the most thing I've seen related to this recently is a new work by Elena Lega in Nice showing that it's possible that this doesn't actually turn over here and that in many cases this might actually keep going up to very high masses. Why that's important is if you're growing a gas giant, instead of getting here, imagine you're growing a gas giant core. You get here, you're accreting some gas. In this model, once you get here, you fall off and you migrate inward. If this boundary kept going upward, then you could reach a true gas giant size, and then, you know, transition to type 2 migration rather than end up having to go inward. So the detailed structure, I would say this is generic, the qualitative structure, but the details can change.
But can you give a feeling, why is that there? I mean, well, you said, you know, you calculate this, and this is what happened. But any general feeling or sense why it's there and not in a different place?
So the key thing is the most important aspect of this diagram for what we're talking about is this lower boundary of the outward migration zone. And what controls that is the strength of the co-rotation torque at a given spot as a function of mass. And that goes up. And the reason that increases with mass is mainly because the actual horseshoe region gets wider. And so the torque felt there gets much stronger because the region gets wider. Does that make sense?
Okay, Bill in the back.
Love that hat. Really is a nice hat.
Oh, thank you.
One thing I take from someone who's more focused on this solar system, one thing I take from this is a very dynamic system. It seems like nothing should have formed in place from what we see now. One of the things I would like to see, because it would help to inform our models for building even this Earth, is the mass growth versus time. I'm seeing a little bit of mass growth versus position. Hmm. And part of that is I'm trying to understand the process that I think we've talked about for a few weeks here, is the formation of asteroid-type bodies that we have products from today that are forming in 1 to 2 million years, and the Earth. And I understood what you said, but I'm still trying to figure that curve in my brain, time versus mass. Now I have a comment.
Do you want me to answer that first? Or?
You can, because it will relate to that answer. The previous diagram really got to me. In fact, it sort of talked about a static system, especially when you had the chondrites up there. I know you didn't address it in detail.
You're talking about this guy?
Yeah. That's a very static diagram. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's sort of drawn on the generalized statement that, I guess, 2 weeks ago in a Nature paper, we said it must be wrong because the gas giants came in, swiped them, and then moved them back into some sort of position. So with this diagram in mind and with the question in mind, I'd like to hear your answer.
Okay. So your question is, in this context, how do we see the mass growth of kind of planetary embryos happening? And that was one of those arrows in that kind of general plot that I showed. The simulations I showed you all started after those things were already formed, the building blocks were formed. But there's kind of the classical model, I would say, for the formation of planetary embryos invokes that planetesimals, you know, kilometer-sized things formed efficiently, then collisional growth can form things that are the size of Mars or the Moon at about 1 AU within 100,000 years or so. That's these, the most famous authors of that are Kokubo and Ida, but many other people have done it. So that's kind of the classical model. There's some new models that can form planetary embryos directly from pebbles by invoking mechanisms that are really efficient at concentrating solids within the disk. And so the reason pebbles are invoked is because those are the, that's a size scale that's the most easily concentrated because it's most sensitive to that kind of drift. So the time frame for that model can be very fast. So simulations show you can concentrate a lot of pebbles into, you know, into somewhere where we think they should slowly collapse and become planetary embryos or or very large planetesimals. And this happens very quickly. The trick is really resolving what's going on within the clump once you've shown that it should concentrate. And so that the details of how that accumulates are still being worked out now. But that can happen very fast, say in 1,000 years. But the trick is, what initial conditions do you need to actually trigger that? And that probably doesn't happen immediately. So I would say, based on what we know now, it's totally reasonable to think that planetary embryos should form within 100,000 years or so around 1 AU. Yeah, and I think that fits with what we've been talking about with the iron meteorites. All right. The static picture. So you're right. This is what this diagram relates is what we measure as to chondrites, different kinds of chondrites, to where they are now. Now, the question is, were they always there? And so we talked about the Grand Tack model, for example, a couple weeks ago. And in that model proposes that these guys all form further out, and that this red and green stuff probably extended further out. And so what we're seeing now is this the result of a very dynamic process. And so really tying it back to what happened before is tricky. And there are different models that do that differently. I mean, I don't know what to say. There's models that invoke that these guys formed out here and then got planted inward, and there's people who think they formed locally. And it's not resolved.
Yes, Sean, I had a question about, that's sort of a follow-up to Svi's question, so it relates to that last, the conclusions chart that you showed. Mm-hmm.
That kind of, this kind of picture there?
Right. Yeah. So it's intuitive how the aerodynamic torques would work in that lowermost dash line that you've got, but could you explain a little bit more clearly how the co-rotation torques work in that outward moving section? And then also, is there any significance to the fact that the turnaround point is 1 AU, or is it that is
no that prior the 1 AU is just a coincidence of this disk model. Okay. I didn't go into the details of this, but the shape of the egg actually changes in time as the disk dissipates. Mm-hmm. And so this is just kind of a snapshot that we used to illustrate, but it's not staying like this forever. And so the co-rotation torque, what happens there is fluid, basically the fluid is moving on these horseshoe orbits. And so what happens, there's in strong interaction where they do the U-turn on each side of the planet. And so when the fluid moves inward, it gives a planet a little kick outward. It goes around the other side and does the opposite and gives a planet a little kick inward. Now, if the cooling time of the gas is such that it's kind of basically the same as the libration time scale of that material, then you can have an imbalance in those that tends in this regime to drive it outward. That's the main effect. So I don't have, in other talks, I have a graph that shows this in all sorts of detail, but I don't think I included it here. But that's the general idea, is it's these two U-turns that are happening, and the cooling time has to be kind of comparable to that the libration time scale for that to be a strong effect.
So I really appreciated this talk, and I liked how you made some predictions. So I want to just make sure I understand your explanation for the high multiplicity systems with lots of super Earths. So it seems like they're supposed to form, or they're supposed to early on be in residence and then undergo some sort of instability, and maybe you lose a few planets, but it seems like a general outcome of that would be remnant eccentricity. So my question is, would you expect that residual eccentricity to persist over the lifetime of the system to the point where we could measure it today? And also, have you thought about, you know, if this is actually measurable? I know that extracting eccentricities from RVs at this point for small planets is not quite there yet, but have you thought about different observables?
This is a very good point. So at this point, right after the migration here, like in this diagram, there's a chain of resonances with quite small eccentricities, say less than a couple percent. Then if everything, you know, breaks, these guys here, you can tell, I didn't explain this too well, but these curves show the perihelion and the aphelion distance of these bodies. So they're not flat, so they have some eccentricity. And the number I was saying is probably something like 5%. I can look it up. I don't know the number off the top of my head. So now your question is, should this actually stick around? And in this case, yeah, it should. There could still be some tidal damping due to interactions with the star that might decrease this guy's eccentricity. Then if it's coupled to the other guys, maybe it can decrease their eccentricities a bit also. But they probably wouldn't go away completely. The trick is, when do they go unstable? And more often than this situation is when, as the planets are actually migrating inward, which is happening, you know, in this tiny little smudged area, as the gas is dissipating, kind of the damping effect of the gas on the system is slowly going away. And the system often breaks while there's still some gas there. And so when that happens, you actually have an extra source of damping right when the instability is happening. And so your final eccentricities tend to be lower. And I don't have numbers for you. I can look these up. But when that happens, then the eccentricities should be systematically lower because you have extra damping while the excitation is actually happening.
Okay, sorry, I'll take the chair's prerogative for the last question, which is, I'm not convinced that the resonances really will go away. In particular, I'm worried that in some of the simulations you'll get just two planets in resonance and that there won't be enough degrees of freedom to go unstable. I know that Goldreich and Schlichting have argued that even two planets might pop out of the resonance after they get into resonance, but supposing there are some systems where there's just two and they start in resonance, would you expect that population to be more than we see in the observations of period ratios?
I knew you were going to ask me this. So yesterday, I found this plot specifically to address what we had talked about the other day of whether these systems of hot supers, if they survive, how they break. And I didn't have a chance to go and figure out. I looked at some resonant angles to try to figure out exactly where it was breaking. But I have not found exactly where that is for you yet.
Well, that plot has tons of planets in resonance. I'm just
exactly.
two planets.
So if you had a case that was much simpler with just a couple planets, then it makes sense that it should be pretty stable. There's the effect of what's it called again? Over-libration. Overstable libration that could maybe destabilize at a later time. Or maybe another thing that's not included in this simulation is the effect of turbulence during migration, which might... what we think it should do is either make it less, weaken the preference for planets to be in perfect resonance, or at least if they are in resonance, not to be so deep in the resonance and be easier to get kicked out. But you're right, I think if you manage to migrate a system in with a small number of planets that are deep in resonance, then in some cases that could be tricky to get rid of.
Yeah. Okay, let's thank our speaker.
Cool. Thank you. Oh, yeah, right, the mic.
All right, as I just referred to, our next speaker is Ilka Schlichting from MIT. She will also talk about the formation of planets. Let's get the title here. Terrestrial planet formation, a blueprint for the formation of close-in super-Earths and mini-Neptunes? Question mark. So can we use the traditional ideas and extend them?